Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries. I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. For those of you not familiar with the series, the way it works is that our guest will read for about 40 minutes or so, after which if you have questions, the floor is open to questions. And we do have a microphone back there if you so choose to use it. Everything that goes on is being taped, and with the writer's permission, we are putting it up on the World Wide Web so that eventually the entire world can listen to our reader tonight and the experience of the Michigan Writers Series. So it's wonderful to have you here this evening. Our guest tonight is Professor Sylvia Watanabe. Professor Watanabe commutes between Honolulu, where her father lives, Grand Rapids, Michigan, where her husband and cats live, and Oberlin, Ohio, where she teaches fiction in the creative writing program at Oberlin College. I just recently found out that Professor Watanabe just received tenure at Oberlin College, so this is a joyous week for her, in addition to appearing here in East Lansing. She has received a Pushcart Prize and an O. Henry Award for her short fiction and her book of stories. Talking to the Dead was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. With Carol Bruschak, she has co-edited two anthologies of Asian American literature, Home to Stay and Into the Fire, published by Greenfield Review Press. She is currently working on a novel. Please join me in welcoming Professor Sylvia Watanabe.
Thank you very much for coming. Is it okay if I move it like this? Can you hear me all right? It's okay? All right. Is it all right? Or did I do something wrong? Okay, I'm always a little nervous around technology. I appreciate very much your coming out this evening. I understand that there's a Michigan State game on. And I'm a fan too, so here we are. I'm going to read tonight from a piece of nonfiction called Knowing Your Place. Before settling in Grand Rapids, my husband and I spent life out of graduate school, on freeways, in U-Haul trucks, pursuing tenure at 55 MPH. We traveled back and forth along I-80 from California to New York, to California to Michigan, jettisoning ballast along the way. The boxes of old Christmas cards were the first to go, along with the deep freeze that could hold 500 pounds of meat. Next went the barbells, king-size sofa bed, a mutual interest in geology, complete with rock collection, and the history of Western civilization by Will and Ariel Durant. Somewhere in Wyoming, I abandoned my fear of driving in the dark. On our second pass through California, I stopped putting rice out for our family ghosts. Bill, my husband, was reassuring. "They'll just go to Honolulu," he said. "They still know the way to your mother's house." I have come to think of home as where I am not, as a place I've just left or a place I have not yet arrived. There are others too, perfect strangers who have apparently given these matters some thought. I usually meet these people when I am walking down a street somewhere. "Chink," they yell from their cars as they speed past. "Why don't you go home?" I was born and raised in Hawaii, on an island maybe 80 miles around. There was no such thing there as a perfect stranger. If people yelled at you from their cars, they were liable to get the epithets right. And if you talked to anyone long enough, you would probably discover that their cousin Albert was related to your uncle Mitsuo's brother-in-law's wife. It would have been impossible not to form those kinds of ties in a landscape where everything, the weather, the fact you were surrounded by water, the distance to anywhere, conspired to make you stay put. But none of what made leaving so difficult prevented the outside, including an enormous variety of exotic plant and animal life, from moving in. My Japanese grandparents, who were Confucian Buddhists on my mother's side and Confucian Presbyterians on my father's, were among the exotics who put their roots down in the islands and never considered anywhere else home again. in Japan, my mother's mother said everyone occupied a place that was already decided. She said, I came to Hawaii to make my own place. She was first made to understand, however, that there was no respectable place for an unmarried, non-Christian Japanese female who didn't speak English except employment as a domestic, then marriage. Only after the births of five children, the death of a son, and widowhood, once more single, but forever respectable, could she finally make a place for herself as head of her family and keeper of the rituals binding us to whatever had come before Hawaii. It was she who taught my mother, then me, that the dead are hungry and must be fed, that home was where they could find their way to us. My father's parents were a different story. They were missionaries, he says, as if that explains everything about them. They were educated in Japan by American Presbyterians who persuaded them to go to Hawaii and attempt to convert the Japanese workers on the sugar plantations. When my grandparents emigrated, it was not so much with the hope of making a place for themselves, but with the confidence that wherever they went, their place in the Lord was already secure. Thy kingdom come, my grandfather wrote in a letter to one of his teachers. All Christians must realize that it is their responsibility to Christianize the world. This belief wasn't shaken when he and my grandmother were informed soon after arriving that the church was unwilling to provide long-term support for their subsidiary efforts. In present-day academic parlance, they were not tenure track. When support ran out, they didn't complain. The Lord would provide. They looked for other ways to secure a living. Grandmother held classes in American cookery and English conversation. Grandfather worked at various times as an insurance salesman, a bookkeeper, and a postman. They moved from one island to another before finally being called by one of the plantation communities on Maui to establish a Japanese language school. We came because they called us, my grandfather said later. Perhaps they could not get anyone else who knew both English and Japanese. Most of the community were from poor farming families, and they could hardly read and write in Japanese. So we taught the children. The parents always had something to translate: immigration papers, bank papers, personal letters. One way or another, I guess you could say, we spread the word. My husband believes that we are carrying on the family tradition. What else would you call what we've been doing since graduate school? He asks, and then points out that as adjunct writing instructors, we too spread the word, go where we're called, and labor under the necessary misapprehension that a higher power will provide. Bill is the first to receive the call to a tenurable position. We are living in Hayward, California, and the English department with tenure is in Allendale, Michigan. It is true that we have always talked of settling on the West Coast, where family is near, but tenure means health insurance, the end to camping out in a chancy job market, and maybe someday a house of our own. While I am apprehensive about my own lack of a position, something is bound to open up. And when Bill suggests that I use the breather to write full time, who am I to resist? He being the higher power who will provide. After many bad adventures in moving, we decide that this time we'll get it right. We will not hold a garage sale. We will not scour the dumpsters of all the local liquor stores for cardboard boxes. We will not hire a 50-foot moving van to drive ourselves. We will not attempt to drive the entire distance in just 2 days. We will not start packing the night before. Many weeks before we are scheduled to leave, Bill goes from room to room measuring things. He measures the bookcases, the queen size bed, the dining set, the dressers, and the computer workstations, and writes all the figures down on a yellow pad. When he is finished, he makes a sweeping gesture that takes in the entire apartment and announces, "We can break most of this stuff down and fit it into a 5x10 trailer." "What about that?" I ask, indicating the suddenly enormous-looking couch. "We'll leave it here," he says. "What about the mattress on the bed?" I ask. "What about all the kitchen stuff? What about our clothes? What about the books?" I am beginning to feel depressed. "Ah, the books." Bill looks thoughtful. "Well, maybe we'll need a 6x12 and a car top carrier." Out of curiosity and desperation, I'm sure everybody has a moving story like this, I begin calling moving companies. The three questions these places always ask are, how big is the load? How much does it weigh? Do you live upstairs? The last is the only question I can answer with certainty, at least until the third call I make. "Do you live upstairs?" the man at the other end of the line asks. "No," I explain, "we live downstairs on the ground floor." He says, "How many flights up did you say that was?" "One," I reply, "down." "But you still have to go up those stairs in order to get out of the apartment, don't you?" he points out. I can't disagree with the logic of that. "Well then, you live up one flight," the man says. "So down is up. What can I say to the other two questions? The load is big, it is enormous, it weighs on us." Whenever we are at the mall, we spend a lot of time at the electronics counter in Macy's. There, we wistfully handle the 2-inch televisions, the portable CD players, the notebook computers, and the micro cassette recorders you can carry in your pocket. Bill says, "Just think how easy it would be to move if we could miniaturize." My grandfather liked to describe how he and my grandmother arrived in the islands with all their belongings in a single trunk. Although he himself had always been fond of a well-made suit, they were embarking on a new life in which it would be necessary to put aside such worldly tastes. And of course, he would add, almost as an afterthought, they could not expect the church to pay their moving expenses. The tenured missionaries sent to the islands by the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions had all of their expenses covered. Their move from Boston to Honolulu is described by Michener in the novel Hawaii. For years, I worked in the education department of the museum run by their descendants, and my job was nothing more than to research, catalog, and make up stories about all the items in the many trunks that came over from Boston. It is quite literally true, not to mention metaphorically significant, that among the things these missionaries brought with them were the disassembled pieces of a 2-story wood frame New England style house. As they themselves recognized, they were not mere purveyors of a spiritual doctrine. They were instruments in the grand endeavor of transplanting an entire material culture. Judging from the present state of development in the islands, the success of this endeavor has surely surpassed their wildest dreams. But when it is not possible to dismantle and move your entire apartment building, or to pare down all your rooms, 5 rooms full of possessions, to a single trunk and the clothes on your back, the question remains, what do you take with you and what do you leave behind? This is the time to face up to the fact that you probably don't need a drawer full of harmonicas, that you will not learn Russian, or take tap dancing lessons, or pick up the alto sax, that you will never manage another recreational baseball team, or put together the 10-speed you took apart and whose headgear you can no longer find. this is the time to realize that you will never again wear the size 2 black bolero jacket that you can't remove from its dry cleaning bag without instantly attracting every single white cat hair in the apartment. This is the time to part with the collection of ceramic bunnies that your cousin in Germany continues to send you every Christmas, as well as the dusty box unopened from the time it was stored in your parents' basement, containing every piece of homework from elementary school. Then there are the things that you would like to discard, but cannot. The things you never desired to collect, but that have accrued nonetheless. These are the memories. The swastika on the carport wall, the dog excrement smeared on the front stoop, the young white men in the pickup pursuing you down the street as you walked home from work. These are the words, gook, nip, dink, slope, chink, jap. These are the questions. What is your nationality? What kind of a name is that? Where is it from? I mean, where are you from? I am a Japanese Confucian Buddhist Presbyterian from Hawaii. My mother's mother and father were born in Yamaguchi Prefecture in Japan. My father's father and mother were born in Fukushima and Gifu. They are all dead now. My husband is a Scotch-Irish-German Christian Scientist Puritan agnostic. His great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, John Coggeshall, became the first governor of Rhode Island after testifying in the trial of Anne Hutchinson and being forced to leave the Massachusetts colony. He is dead now, too. Here is a photo of my grandfather taken when he was still a very young man. He is dressed in a white suit, his arms full of roses. There is something Wildian and un-Presbyterian about his pose, about the way he gazes languidly upon the flowers. Here is a formal portrait of him and my grandmother taken in a photography studio. My grandmother's so small and neat, her beatific smile, her slim legs crossed at the ankles, her hands folded in her lap. Grandfather stands next to her with his perfect posture, his perfect suit, his arms hanging at his sides. His expression is familiar, the gaze off to the distance, beyond the frame of the camera. His eyeglasses glint, so I can't see his eyes. On the back of the photo, someone has written, 27th anniversary, 1141. A couple of weeks later, early on the morning of December 8th, the military police came to my grandparents' house. My grandfather, grandmother, and two youngest aunts were the only ones living there. My father was working in Honolulu, and the next three oldest children were all away at college. It was very dark, as my Aunt Dorothy remembers. Everyone was roused from their sleep by the sound of loud knocking at the front door. When Grandfather went to answer, he was confronted by armed military police who told him to get dressed, then took him out to a truck parked on the front drive. After posting a guard, they went back inside and searched the house. Grandfather was taken to the Maui County Jail, where he was incarcerated in an 8x10 cell for 6 months before being shipped to a temporary holding facility outside of Honolulu. Just before his departure, he wrote a letter to the Maui headquarters for military intelligence, asking permission for one last visit with the family. The letter says, "Dear Lieutenant Sir, I, as an internee, hereby respectfully submit this petition for granting me your special permission to visit my home in Waikapu, only 1.5 miles from here, just once before my transference to the place designated by the military authority." It is not from selfishness, but from a natural humanness that I desire to meet my family before my long departure. The house I have lived in for many years is where my six children grew up. I hope to have my last meal with my wife, mother-in-law, and two young daughters. It will not take more than 3 or 4 hours. This has been crossed out and changed to 4 or 5 hours. We'll use English only in our conversation under the military guard to be provided for me. I will not say anything regarding the war or about the detention camp and will observe the rules and regulations we are to follow. I have been a faithful resident of Hawaii for 35 years. I am contented with the treatment I am now being dealt, but I fearlessly state here, in the presence of our living God, that I am innocent, though it is not the purpose of this letter to clarify my innocence. Respectfully submitted by Yakichi Watanabe. The military authority granted him his request. A few days later, when my father went to visit him after he'd been moved, grandfather, always the man of words, asked for a Spanish dictionary. "They are sending us to New Mexico," he said, "and I hear they speak Spanish there." The day before Bill and I begin our drive to Michigan, we go down to the nearest U-Haul to pick up the trailer. We talk to someone named Frank, who confirms after looking it up in his book that we'll be more than okay with a 6x12, which is the maximum size that a Ford Fairmont can pull. He asks where we are headed, and when we tell him vaguely, because we are not sure ourselves, somewhere in the vicinity of Grand Rapids, he says, "I'm from Wyoming." Bill and I look at each other, then he says to Frank, "That's great. There's some beautiful country in Wyoming." Frank laughs, "If you like Dutchmen." Then he explains that he is talking about Wyoming, Michigan, a township in the greater Grand Rapids area. "Yep, there sure are a lot of Dutchmen there." I glance again at Bill, who is staring at the blonde, blue-eyed Frank. "Are you Dutch?" Bill asks. Frank says, "Hell no, I considered myself lucky when I got out." Early the next morning, with the help of Bill's son, who has driven up from Southern California, we begin loading the trailer. When we are done, it is a job of engineering precision from top to bottom, front to back, each object fitting the next like pieces in a Rubik's cube. Bill looks at his watch and notes that it isn't even 11 o'clock. We'll be on our way even earlier than we'd planned. But when we walk around to the side to admire our work from a different perspective, his son says, "It's probably nothing, but is the back end of the Ford always at a 25-degree angle?" As we stand there debating whether this is a peculiar design feature we have never noticed before, one of the other tenants in our building calls out as he walks by, "Looks like you've got more than you can handle." Bill goes to the manager's office and calls Frank at U-Haul, who informs him that we can solve our problem by redistributing the load. "Just make sure to put the heaviest things over the axles and the lightest things up front," Frank says. When Bill and his son have finished unloading the trailer and reloading it, it is not as precise a job as the first time, but they have managed to get everything back inside except for two large boxes containing old textbooks from college. The slope of the chassis is down about 2 degrees, which is not that much of an improvement when we consider that the interior of the car is completely jammed now as well. There is nothing to do but lighten the load. As Bill's son gets into his truck to drive back down to San Diego, we are throwing our college textbooks into the dumpster at the far end of the parking lot. Hayward is in the San Francisco Bay Area, where there are lots of hills. Each time we struggle up a hill, the inertia of the trailer pulls in the opposite direction. Whenever we hit a downhill, the trailer looms in the rear view, threatening to race full out over the top of the car. With every bump, sparks fly. The hitch, which extends below the bumper, scrapes bottom hard. After we have gone a couple of miles in this fashion, we pull up to a dumpster in a Denny's parking lot, where we empty out the back seat. Next follows a stop at the back entrance of the city library, where we leave more boxes of books placed neatly beside the overnight book return. After each jettisoning of ballast, we look hopefully at our Ford, which continues to retain its backward tilt. By now it is getting late, so we head for a friend's house in San Francisco, a drive that usually takes 30 minutes during off traffic without an overloaded trailer. Of course, it is now the peak of rush hour. The next morning, Bill takes everything out of the trailer for the third time. Our friend has kindly offered to let us store part of the load in her basement. "Then you'll have to come back and see us again," she says. I burst into tears. As we are driving on the beautiful Oakland Bay Bridge over beautiful San Francisco Bay, I have the cat on my lap, and we are gazing out the passenger seat window, thinking mournful thoughts and watching our beautiful city falling away. Suddenly, Bill says, "Uh-oh, trouble." I say, "Like we haven't had trouble already?" He says, "This is serious. Smoke." I look out the rear window, and there it is, a black, metallic-smelling cloud billowing out the back. We speculate that maybe if we slow down, it will get better. And it does. I can't resist asking, does this mean that we have to drive at 30 miles an hour all the way to Michigan? He doesn't answer. That night, we make another unexpected stop in Applegate at a little motel with a fire station motif. Bill rises early and spends the morning under the hood. He closes it back up without even attempting surgery. There is nothing he can do to make our Ford pull that trailer any faster. When we figure it out, we have been averaging 33 miles a day, including backtracking. And at this rate, we won't get to Grand Rapids for another 3 months. That's when we decide to make our move with Corrigan. After looking up the address in the phone book, we drive over and leave them our load. Next, we go to U-Haul and drop off the 6x12. Now the car behaves well, but the cat has decided that she has had enough. As we are crossing the Sierras, she begins to yowl. When we don't turn around and go back, or as she would prefer, stop this minute right where we are, she crawls under the front seat and refuses to emerge. This is August of 1988, a summer of record heat. There is drought everywhere, and the reports over the radio say that the corn crop is dying all across the Midwest. It is 115 degrees when we get to the Nevada desert. A little less than halfway, we stop for gas, and I drag the cat out from her hiding place. She's a rag, barely conscious. I plunge her into the ice chest and attempt feline resuscitation. From that point on, we decide to travel at night. The night is still hot, but it is not as bad as the day. The darkness and the desert go on forever. I think of my grandfather in that other desert all those years ago. When the bombs fell on Pearl Harbor, his place in the world, like that of thousands of others, was blown to bits. Over and over in the letters he wrote after first being taken into custody, he tries to recover that place. Unsure of the charges against him, he protests his innocence. He has learned English, he says, to assimilate myself into American life in every respect. And if that is not sufficient evidence of his loyalty, none of his children has, quote, ever visited a foreign country. They were expatriated from Japan in order to confirm their American citizenship. I have helped hundreds of other Japanese children in their procedure of expatriation from Japan without taking any fee, he says. But when he was unsuccessful at recovering his lost place, grandfather decided, finally, to accept that too. We can hope someday, though not in our lives, that all people of the world will truly wake up to the will of our God and live all races harmoniously. Thy kingdom come. The most difficult journey he ever had to make was not between his home on Maui and the internment camp in New Mexico. It was not a journey measured in geographical distance, but in the space, the entire desert between two nouns, missionary, alien. My husband and I have lived in Grand Rapids for the last 8 years. Actually, it's more like 12 now. It is a town of clean, well-kept streets and house-proud neighborhoods. Since our arrival, we have moved 3 times. In our first apartment, we lived across the hall from a college student with a fondness for heavy metal music at 2 in the morning. In our second apartment, we lived downstairs from a World War II veteran with Alzheimer's. One morning after I'd gone to the market, the front door was ajar while I set the bags of groceries down in the kitchen. When I went to close the door, the World War II veteran was in our living room looking dazed. I asked if he needed help, and he turned toward me. He froze for an instant, his eyes as round as saucers. Then he ran out of the apartment yelling, "The Japs are here!" And so I am. Bill and I now write and teach. We have tenure at our respective colleges. We own a house in a tree-shaded neighborhood with woods and a little lake nearby. All the men here are named Bud, Ted, Bob, Jim, Skip, and Bill adds, or Bill. On Saturdays in the summer, these men with one-syllable names can be heard calling to each other when they go outside to mow their lawns. Bud, our next-door neighbor, is 80 years old. He brings us fresh strawberries, cucumbers, and tomatoes from his garden. I give him macadamia nuts that my parents have sent me. Bud says that he, too, has spent some time in Hawaii. Not like the tourists, he is quick to add. For a while, when they were going there every winter, he and his wife considered the islands a second home. When Bill and I decide to dig up our backyard and put in flowers, Bud lends us his sod cutter. He comes over to help us dig up the sod and turn over the soil. Another time, he brings us an enormous spool made of wood and metal that he has constructed in his basement shop. "Thought you could use something like this for the cord on your electric mower," he says. When I am outside working in the garden, he likes to come over and chat. He tells me stories about his travels. He talks about how he went to Egypt one time, about how often he's visited Europe. A memory comes to me of my grandfather as a very old man in his 90s. He is in a white cotton t-shirt and long white cotton underwear, crouched on the floor of his study over a roll of rice paper, inkbrush in hand. He is scribbling over and over in Japanese, "Thy kingdom come, thy kingdom come," a prayer, a hope, an unfinished notion. Thank you. I guess I would take questions if anybody has them. Yes.
You mentioned that
The question is whether when epithets have been called at me, whether I respond or react as a passive Asian American woman. Mostly, I suppose I have reacted as a passive Asian American woman, but I did write this essay. Any other questions? Yes. Yes.
How would you characterize sort of a racial slur versus things that anyone come? I mean, you must have also had insults by Japanese ancestor people from you. So how do you distinguish it?
Well, that is an interesting question. I think that people are I guess the question here is how racial epithets differ from other kinds of unkind name calling. In some ways, they don't differ. Because children who are, or I'm not answering this very well, children are often hurt by remarks of other people for being different. And those kinds of that kind of pain that's inflicted by those sorts of remarks, I don't think people ever forget. The thing about the racial epithets, I suppose, is that they have always been so surprising to me, and that I never knew where they would come from or what prompted them. And of course, there is also a long history of racial difficulty in our country to which those kinds of epithets are attached.
What made you decide to call your book Talking to the Dead and not one of your other short stories?
There's a Hawaiian funerary custom in which people who are friends of someone who has died or relatives come to pay their last respects, and they bring objects to the deceased person that were favorite objects of that person during life. They also come to just talk to that person. If they have unresolved issues, they try to talk to the dead person about those issues and come to some sort of resolution. So it's a time of forgiveness and sort of opening and a loving sort of time. So that's why I called my book that.
Thank you.
Yes. That is to emphasize, I think, in some ways, a person's so-called station in life and also to make fun of it. Yeah.
Also, literary influences on you. Do you have
it? Oh, yes, I do. I like Virginia Woolf very much. And also, Jamaica Kincaid was very important to me when I was writing that book, because one of the things about Kincaid is that she manages to evoke place without necessarily having to mess with dialect or anything like that. She evokes it primarily through the use of detail, and I wanted to be able to do that, to have sort of a smooth surface to the text without sort of breaking between dialect and standard English. Any other questions? Yes.
Any indications that your maiden name, have you
Have I ever changed my name to my husband's name? For a little while, I messed with the hyphenated thing, Watanabe Osborne. And you can see why that didn't last. Yeah.
So what made you keep your maiden name, American costume?
My father has two daughters. And the name sort of ends here. So that was one reason. And also because it is my name, and I've always felt comfortable with my name. Yes? My office, wherever that is. I work at Oberlin College, and I've got a little apartment down there, and it's a very quiet little town. So I found that it's a very good place to write. I have long stretches of sort of isolation, and so that's very nice to work there. Yes? Yes. I like both. That's kind of a waffly answer. But right now I'm working on a novel, which is a new sort of challenge for me. And in a way, that came out of experiments that I was doing with my writing when I switched to nonfiction for a little while. Yes, yes. Okay, the question is basically whether my writing is autobiographical. I was asked this question a lot after having written Talking to the Dead, which really wasn't autobiographical. My family steadfastly refuses to recognize themselves in the book at all. And really, I don't know any. They keep saying, we don't know anybody like that. And we kind of don't. But I turned to nonfiction and to drawing on actual elements from life, partly because of those questions. Yes, so in the nonfiction, very definitely. Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me here.